Welcome to episode 129 of Primary Care Update. I'm Kate Rowland, family physician and associate professor at Rush University.
Hi, I'm Gary Ferencik, a general internist and professor of medicine at Michigan State University.
Hi, I'm Henry Barry, a family physician and one of the co-founders of InfoPalms. Mark is out of the country right now, and the reason I mention this is that I am the substitute audio technician, so I'm sure that any hiccups that we encounter along the way are going to be my fault. I did want to mention that yesterday I was over on the campus of Michigan State University as a reviewer for a Center of Excellence program that our colleagues Wanda Lipscomb and Bill Anderson run. And I heard presentations from four young faculty that were just outstanding and covered the spectrum of some of the things that we try to address. Healthcare diversity, social determinants of health, patient adherence, as well as a lot of interesting research design and the like. So I wanted to give a shout out for the excellent program that they put on.
Thanks, Henry. On this podcast, we highlight patient-oriented evidence that matters, or POEMS. If you want all of the POEMS, subscribe to Essential Evidence, where you get a POEM every day, plus a great primary care reference with over 800 disease and symptom chapters and thousands of interaction decision support tools. Check it out at EssentialEvidencePlus.com. As you know, the opinions expressed on Primary Care Update are those of the commentators, and this podcast does not represent medical advice or the endorsement of any product. For a small annual fee, you can receive CME credit from the Illinois Academy of Family Physicians just for listening to this podcast. Just go to IAFP.com, click on online education webpage, and find our podcast. Coming up this week, we're going to discuss a clinical support tool to discuss mortality risk in patients presenting with acute heart failure, a new intranasal medication for treating acute migraine attacks, and treatment of low-grade prostate cancer. Now, usually this is the part where Mark would stop talking and I would start, but since Mark is in Italy, I'm just going to keep talking.
Can we have a moment of silence, though?
Just a little bridge. It's good. Fortunately for all the listeners, it's not my week for the quiz, so it'll be a little break from the continuous sound of my voice. This week I have a clinical decision tool. As you know, there's nothing I like more than support when making decisions. This one looks at triage of patients with heart failure in the emergency department. These were Canadian investigators. They enrolled patients presenting with acute heart failure in emergency departments at 10 hospitals. They excluded patients who had end-stage heart failure or those receiving palliative care. They randomized at the hospital trial or at the hospital level, and this was a crossover trial. So hospitals participated in both a control phase and an intervention phase. And I love crossover trials. I just think they're brilliant research design. Patients who presented during the control phase, there were about 2,900 of them, received usual care. And those who presented during the intervention phase, about 2,500, were assessed using this clinical decision-making support strategy. So with the strategy, the clinicians had access to this validated point of care tool. It's called the Emergency Heart Mortality Grade - 30 days - including ST depression. There's a convoluted acronym for that. If you access our script, you can see a link to it. But it triaged patients to low, intermediate, or high risk of death at both 7 and 30 days. The risk calculator includes clinical features like age, blood pressure, O2 sat, potassium level, troponins, ST depression. There's 11 total clinical points of information that feed into this calculator. So patients who, using that information, wound up being categorized to low risk were recommended for early discharge, either from the ED or after an observation period of up to 3 days. So that's a little bit of a long hospitalization, followed by transitional care to a heart failure clinic, a specialty heart failure clinic, for up to 30 days. High risk were recommended for admission to the hospital. And then there's this intermediate risk pool, and they were triaged based on clinical judgment. So just sort of as we would usually do. Intervention and control groups were balanced at baseline. Average age was almost 80, 78 years. 45% were female. And both groups had a similar number of early discharges among low-risk patients. In the intermediate risk group, though, There were more early discharges in the intervention group and a decreased rate in the high-risk group. So just sort of exactly what you'd expect. Clinical judgment was about right for the low risk, but it was able to decrease, able to sort of emphasize appropriate risk care for those higher-risk patients. Primary outcome was all-cause death or non-elective hospitalization for cardiovascular causes, and that was lower in the intervention group, appropriately so. At both 30 days and at 20 months. So both short-term and long-term outcomes were successful in this group, primarily driven by fewer cardiovascular hospitalizations rather than all-cause mortality. So conclusions here, patients who come into the ER with acute heart failure, this validated point of care tool for risk stratification seems effective. So that's recommendation for early discharge with rapid follow-up, again, with a specialty heart failure clinic, which is something that in all reality could be done in primary care. There's nothing that they did in this heart failure clinic that couldn't be done by a wise family doc or a general internist. Again, it's both risk stratification and early somewhat specialized or aggressive outpatient management. So both, if we want to implement this in primary care, would have to be both components. And this could be done both by our ED colleagues and by us when we admit patients for heart failure. So knowing, is this somebody who could potentially be rapidly discharged or somebody who we really want to hang on to for a little bit longer and keep a closer eye on? Henry, what do you think?
Well, first, thank you for that summary, but I just want to reflect my admiration for your willingness to take on complex studies and to summarize them in a way that gets to the heart of the matter, and especially around topics that you aren't necessarily comfortable with or that you enjoy, like these clinical decision rules. My other reflection is around clinical decision rules, as well as many other diagnostic tests that are out there. A lot of the studies that we report just give us information about their diagnostic accuracy, but not on whether they are useful. And quite often, some of these things get interpolated into our processes of care. They either add an additional cognitive step or additional cost to our patients. So this one is unique because it actually tries to look at the actual effect on the decision-making process and subsequent decisions that are made. And so to me, this was a much more useful kind of study. And as you pointed out, that the utility was that, you know, small differences in the primary outcome, but the main effect being on the hospital readmission rates. And so, so I just like the idea of evaluating rigorously the impact of our diagnostic processes.
Yeah, I agree. Gary. I think the it looks like it's cost neutral, Kate. I mean, I'm just using my oculometer here, but you had fewer admissions for the low-risk patients, but more admissions for the intermediate or high-risk patients. And so I'm wondering whether or not, you know, in some ways this, they didn't look at it through the lens of cost. But what I think is most important is you give the appropriate care to the appropriate patient at the appropriate time, which is really what I think this in, you know, it's not a huge difference. We're talking about a 2-3% absolute difference, but you know, that is something when you're talking about hundreds and hundreds of patients. So,
right. Appropriateness of care, I think was the big push here.
And a small reduction here is a big deal. Remember, heart failure is Medicare's single most expensive condition to treat. And so small differences, not only do they impact our patients, but also impact the system of care.
And 30-day readmission rates for heart failure is huge. So this idea of not just discharging them when it's appropriate, but discharging them into a setting where they're going to be actually cared for their primary condition. So,
right. So in both groups, about half of them were readmitted within 20 months. It was a little more than half, actually. So. All right, Gary, it is your quiz.
All right, very simple quiz. My previous ones have been too long, so here's the quiz. In screening for prostate cancer, which of the following statements are accurate? There's only three, so you got to choose one. Screening with PSA has been associated with an improved all-cause mortality in men screened. MRI-enhanced screening has been associated with an improved all-cause mortality in men who are appropriately screened, or MRI-enhanced screening has been associated with fewer cases of overdiagnosis of prostate cancer.
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned. Yeah, they're on their end of
the dramatic seat.
Well, you know, in my practice, I deal with this stuff all the time. So it's very relevant to my practice.
All right, Henry, over to you.
So my study asks whether a new intranasal gepant, zavegepant, is effective in relieving acute migraine attacks in adults. This was published by Lipton and colleagues in March in Lancet Neurology. So this was a double-blinded randomized trial. They enrolled nearly 1,300 adults who had had at least 1 year of migraines, and they had to have between 2 and 8 migraine attacks per month. And this was not about severity, but it was a practical issue. If you're going to have a big study around a medication that is used on an as-needed basis, you want to have people who have an adequate number of attacks so that you can have events, if you will. They were randomized to either intranasal zavegepant, it was a 10 milligram per dose, or a matching placebo. And they had these little doohickeys that were single dose delivery devices. If for some reason the device failed or the patient sneezed or otherwise wasn't administered, they did not redose them. Okay. Now, the International Headache Society has a number of standard outcomes that they want people to consider, one of which is to be pain-free after 2 hours. So that's one of the outcomes in this study. And it turns out that those that got the active intervention, about 24% were pain-free compared to about 15% who got the placebo. That works out to be a number needed to treat of 12. Now, the other thing that they did was that they gave the patients a forced choice of three items that they could say, which of these are historically your most bothersome symptom? Nausea, phonophobia, and photophobia. So using that as an outcome, the most bothersome symptom, it turns out that the differences were 40% versus 31%. Again, a number needed to treat of about 12. With pain outcomes, one of the other things that we often will like to do is to triangulate to look at other markers of pain relief. And so rescue therapy was the other outcome that they reported. And it turns out that almost two-thirds of those that got the active intervention compared to 70% who received placebo needed some kind of rescue therapy, and that difference was a number needed to treat of about 17. About a third of those who received this newer medication experienced adverse events, mostly in the form of dysgeusia or altered taste sensation, compared to about 16% in the placebo group. None of this was severe enough to say that we aren't going to continue using this. Now, this is an interesting novel new medication, but I just want to point out that the triptans are very effective. A 2014 Cochrane evidence review found that for zolmitriptan to be pain-free at 2 hours, the number needed to treat is 5. Okay, half of what it was for this new agent. And at goodrx.com, the cost of 9 tablets, and I just checked this last night, ranged from $13 to $115. Now, we don't have price information on this new thing, but all of the other gepants have typically been in the $700 to $900 range. And now the other part, you know, I like to sometimes raise conspiracy theories. So I looked for this article because of the press report that came out around the FDA approval, which happened on March 23rd. This was in the March issue of Lancet Neurology. Interesting timing. Is it a coincidence? I'm going to guess maybe not.
It's not that kind of podcast, Henry.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
That must be your other podcast.
Your Area 52 podcast.
No, we can always count on Henry to take all of the good talking points, too.
Oh, sorry.
No, I was going to make a similar point that the triptans have, a number needed to treat of somewhere between 4 and 6, depending on the triptan for pain relief at 2 hours. Even the intranasal triptan, which actually does not work as well. The big benefit of it is that you can use it if nausea and vomiting are a major symptom, but has a little bit of a higher number needed to treat. So efficacy-wise, evidence suggests does not work quite as well. So somewhere between 6 and 8 for the lower dose, 4 to 6 again for the higher dose of intranasal sumatriptan. And of course, the subcutaneous one actually has a slightly lower number needed to treat, so slightly higher effectiveness, but unclear whether that's mostly placebo effect from the mode of administration, or if that's because it actually does work better. But of course, we don't yet have a subcutaneous Gepant, as far as I know, except for the one for prophylaxis, which are not approved right now for the abortive therapy, as you're discussing. So. Yeah, it's great to have options. Like you said, cost is going to be a big consideration. But certainly for people who aren't able to tolerate triptans or who have a contraindication to them, good to have options. I love that it has so many Z's in it. Big seller. I think that's actually marketers use that as an indication.
I've heard that in the past. Yes, and X's and Q's I think are equally valuable in terms of that. No, I agree with everything you said, Kate and Henry. It just seems to me that this might be a nice second option, basically after the triptans.
I didn't dwell on this so much, and there's a part of me that, you know, balancing kindness and pragmatism against research rigor, that high rate of rescue medication use to achieve that 2-hour pain-free status, how much benefit is there from the active intervention without rescue therapy, and how much of this was actually attributable to the aggressiveness of the alternate interventions?
Yeah, I think, you know, you said rescue medication was 64% versus 70%. That's a fair amount of rescue medication in both groups. And so saying, yep. You know, like they market sumatriptan in combination with naproxen. And, you know, I think, well, if you're taking the sumatriptan, you may as well just take another one, you know, at the same time in, you know, take both tablets together and save yourself, you know, $100 per pill. But yeah, I think that's very common in people who have migraines. So that one doesn't bother me. All right. Interesting. We'll see what it costs when it comes to market and how many prior auths you have to complete in order to get it covered. Let's talk about prostate cancer, Gary.
All righty, prostate cancer. So there's two back-to-back articles I'm going to review quickly. And then obviously the quiz was related to prostate cancer screening as well. So I thought there was a certain symmetry with my process this week. So the first one is a 15-year outcomes after monitoring, that is active surveillance, surgery, or radiotherapy for prostate cancer. It's the PROTECT trial, prostate testing for cancer and treatment. It was published in the New England Journal, I think, in April, about a month ago. And then a companion article a month previous to that was patient-reported outcomes in the same cohort after 12 years of basically either going through radiotherapy, surgery, or monitoring. So the purpose of this first study, and basically both studies, honestly, was to evaluate the relative effectiveness of active monitoring, prostatectomy, and radiotherapy on prostate cancer-specific and all-cause mortality. Did they have a pulse or not? Also, secondary outcomes of metastasis and disease progression. So this started in the UK in 1999, and they enrolled 82,000 men between 1999 and 2009, mean age of 50 to 69. They all had a PSA, and of that 82,000 men, about 2,600 were diagnosed with prostate cancer. Of the men that were diagnosed with prostate cancer, about 1,600 ultimately agreed to be randomized. And so they were randomized to active monitoring, having prostatectomy, and having radiotherapy. The mean PSA of the men entering was quite low, actually. The mean PSA of the men entering the trial was 4.6, and about three-quarters of them were Gleason grade 6, meaning that the vast majority were at low or favorable intermediate risk. Now, as mentioned, the primary outcome was death from prostate cancer, which was similar after 15 years in all three groups. In addition, overall mortality, whether they were alive or not, was also no difference between all three groups. So it was about 2.7% for the prostate cancer mortality and 21% for the overall mortality. So no difference in mortality. It didn't matter whether you were under active surveillance, prostatectomy, or radiotherapy. What about secondary outcomes? Well, secondary outcomes were metastatic disease, which occurred in about 10% in the active monitoring group versus about 5% in the other group. So you had about a twofold increase of metastatic disease, 5 to 10% in those who were treated versus those who were under active surveillance. Another secondary outcome, which I didn't mention earlier, was androgen deprivation therapy, which occurred in about 13% of the men in the active surveillance versus about 7% in the other two groups. And then clinical progression occurred in about 25% versus about 10 and 11%. So men in the active surveillance group did have a progression of some of these secondary outcomes. Now, the companion article that I mentioned also looked at, okay, in addition to these, we're going to call them harder outcomes, how did the patients feel? You know, were they having, you know, symptoms that were bothersome for them? So they looked at the generic quality of life scores, and they were no different between the three groups. But when they were very specific about urinary-related symptoms, GU-related symptoms, there were some differences. So active urinary leakage requiring pads, 2 to 3 times higher in the prostatectomy group than the other two groups. Adequate erections were not common in any of the groups, but were worse in the prostatectomy group. About 20% had adequate erections versus about 30% in the other two groups. Nocturia was actually better in men who were subjected to prostatectomy. About 30% had nocturia that was defined as 2 times per night versus about 50% in the other two groups. And perhaps, as you might intuit, radiation therapy was more likely, about twice as likely to be associated with fecal leakage. So the authors concluded a couple of things. First of all, 25% of the patients on active monitoring over 15 years now never required treatment for their prostate cancer. They also concluded that the choice of therapy involves weighing the trade-offs between the benefits and harms associated with the treatment of localized prostate cancer. So remember, this is localized prostate cancer. Almost all the men had Gleason 6. Higher grades were included, but there wasn't enough N in them for them to do a separate analysis. So they actually did not include a separate analysis. So I think it's quite helpful. Treatment for prostate cancer has changed over the last 20 years or so. So this may not be absolutely contemporary at this point, but nevertheless, it provides some useful data globally to help patients think through. First of all, not only do they want to get screened, because screening then is easy. It's everything that happens after screening that has the potential for harm.
Yeah, so this is just treatment. We're going to talk in a minute about screening. This doesn't help us figure out which patients might need screening or might be indicated for screening, but it is helpful, like you said, to know if you have somebody who's diagnosed with those low grade. Although, as you said, they included sort of anybody who is diagnosed with prostate cancer, that mortality is the same, which is an interesting outcome. That no matter what therapy they wound up choosing and how that sort of shared decision-making discussion was had, that mortality is the same. And it is interesting to have all of these, long-term follow-up about the different adverse effects. But it's sort of what kind of, it's useful info to have when patients are being counseled about, their choices in terms of cancer therapy. It is hard, I think, for people to hear, there's cancer in your body, but leaving it there is just an absolutely reasonable option. Cancer there, it's just not going to kill you. And if we take it out, you're going to be using a Depends for the rest of your life. Henry?
Thank you. So one of my questions, especially thinking about the mean PSA of being 4.6, how many of these were screen detected versus symptom detected cancers? And then the natural question is whether or not there's a difference between those who are symptomatic versus those who are detected in an asymptomatic state. And I suspect that there are some secondary analyses that may be coming down the line soon on this. I am always a bit apprehensive when a focus is on cause-specific mortality. All-cause mortality is incontrovertible, as you point out, Gary. Cause-specific mortality, we know the issues around the sticky diagnosis by biases and the like, and so. I put a bit more stock into the all-cause mortality, unless there's some really clear operational definitions and complete, adequately blinded assessment by those who determine whether or not it's prostate cancer specific. So these data are really helpful. And the tone of this study is very similar to the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommendation around screening, which is largely around shared decision-making. And I think once you have that person with the diagnosis, these are the kinds of data that can help a man decide which avenue they are most comfortable with. And again, our shared decision-making capabilities as primary care clinicians, this should be in our wheelhouse. Well, all you really need are just a few tools to help guide that process. And the task force, for example, has a very nice infographic that just shows the in a pictorial fashion what are the current outcomes of various screening options. We should have very similar kinds of things around the next step, which is what happens now that you're diagnosed.
Yeah, I agree. To Kate's point earlier, one of the authors in an editorial that was accompanying brought up this issue of anxiety about, you know, untreated cancer. He says, although at times patients remain anxious about leaving cancer untreated, however, treating anxiety by removing a prostate often creates larger problems. So I thought that was well stated, treating anxiety by removing a prostate. All right. Are we ready for the quiz answer?
Can't wait.
All right. So the correct answer was C. So remember, let me go back to the question here. So the question was, in screening for prostate cancer, which of the following statements is accurate? Screening with PSA has been associated with an improved all-cause mortality. That's not accurate. MRI enhanced screening has been associated with an improved all-cause mortality. Also not accurate. But C, or number three, is true. That is, MRI enhanced screening has been associated with fewer cases of overdiagnosis. So remember, overdiagnosis is a large problem when it comes to prostate cancer screening. And again, overdiagnosis really is this conceptual framework that we're finding disease that would not have otherwise harmed the person during their natural life. So the only possible outcome for these people is downside, right? You're treating them for a disease which otherwise would have remained asymptomatic, okay? So that's what overdiagnosis is. So the conceptual framework here is, can we leverage existing technology, MRI-related technology, to decrease the rates of overdiagnosis? This study was published in 2022 in the New England Journal of Medicine, and they asked the question, what if the standard procedure of quadrantic biopsies, I think there's 12 biopsies in both lobes, six on each side, is the usual standard when it comes to screening, or what do I say, biopsying for prostate cancer in men who have high PSAs. What if we actually were more targeted based upon what the MRI of the prostate showed? 18,000 Swedish men between 50 and 60, relatively young, were screened and then had an MRI of their prostate done if their PSA was greater than 3. Again, fairly low bar there. 33%, excuse me, of these 18,000 men underwent routine care. They had the 12 regional biopsies, regardless of the MRI results. And then 2/3 of them actually had only MRI positive lesions that were biopsied. What they found then was that clinically insignificant cancers, they said Gleason 6, basically, or lower, was 0.6% in the MRI group versus 1.2% in the reference group. So they found fewer clinically insignificant cancers. What was the trade-off? There was a slightly higher miss rate when it came to this idea of clinically significant cancers, which were picked up in basically 0.9% of the MRI versus 1.1% in the reference group. So the authors concluded that limiting biopsy to MRI positive lesions led to a substantial reduction in the rate of clinically insignificant cancers, but missed a small number of clinically significant cancers. I've not started doing this yet, but comments? I mean, it certainly seems like for men who are interested in being screened, this may be an option. I'm pretty confident the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force hasn't piped in on this yet.
But this would be you have an elevated PSA, you follow that with an MRI to inform your biopsy. So this isn't exactly screening, this is follow-up of an already abnormal.
Good point. Somebody's already decided to be screened, so that is a very good point. They've already jumped off that ship.
Right, which again, I mean, you mentioned this earlier, but I think it is worth highlighting that this is a C recommendation at the moment, which doesn't mean don't do. It means, you know, patient by patient decision. It's a shared decision, just because it's a mix of evidence, and not a clear avoid this procedure. So for screening for prostate cancer.
And this goes back to the point that I made early about the clinical decision rule. So is the MRI actually going to decrease the overall rate of biopsies, or are we just interpolating yet another procedure, another cost and inconvenience to the patients and to the healthcare systems on our path to diagnostic certainty?
Well, you all both probably remember when prostate ultrasounds were the thing, right? And those kind of fell by the wayside fairly quickly because the accuracy, I think, was actually not as good as you might intuit with the MRI.
Well, I guess we'll keep treating anxiety with prostatectomy. So we should try it even for people without prostate cancer. See how it works. See if it works. All right. Well, thanks everyone for listening today. We look forward to getting Mark's feedback on how this one went. Again, feel free to visit us at IAFP.com, online IAFP education webpage if you would like CME credit for this. We are accredited by the ACCME. The IAFP is accredited by the ACCME to provide CME for this podcast. We hope you all enjoyed today's discussion. Please tell your friends, and we'll talk to you soon with more primary care updates. Thank you.